Genesis chapter 38. Now, before we look at our chapter, I have a passage of Scripture here. And there's a mistake in this passage. All right? There's a mistake here. I'm going to see who of you is sharp enough to figure out what's wrong with this passage. This is the passage. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard, or yours might say the chamberlain of the butchers or the eunuch, or we don't know quite how to translate it. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. Adonai was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Okay, what's wrong with that passage? Tim? The what? No, that's not wrong. No, that's exactly out of the Scriptures the way it's recorded. But good guess, good try. Because there is some discussion about Midianites and Ishmaelites because it discusses both of them. But that is not the error here. Anybody else want to take a stab at this? Yes, Bob. Well, that's what the Scriptures say. So that's not the error either. No, Potiphar was a successful man, according to Egyptian terms. Anybody else figure out the error? Now, Brian's cheating. He's looking in his Bible there. All right, I'm going to tell you what the problem is. Right here, there's something missing, right there. And you know what's missing? Chapter 38. The first sentence is the last verse of chapter 37. Then the second sentence is the first verse of chapter 39. And chapter 38 takes place right there. Now, this is the second chapter in Genesis that does this. The other chapter is that train wreck back in chapter 34. Remember that? Chapter 34 is one of those chapters that if you went from 33 right to 35, you wouldn't notice anything missing in the narrative. But you got 34, which is an absolute train wreck. And this one, this chapter in chapter 38, is lining itself up to be a train wreck. But chapter 38 turns out completely differently. Now, a study you can do on your own is to take 34 and 38 and begin to compare them. You're going to see several differences. You're going to see in each chapter a man. In 34, it's Jacob, and in 38, it's his son Judah, have just had an experience with a brother. Jacob with Esau, Judah with Joseph. And then they go the wrong way. Jacob goes up to Shechem, and here Judah is going down to Adullam and then to Timnah. They're in the wrong place. Each chapter has a woman as one of the main characters. In chapter 34, it's Dinah, and she is. Her brothers say she has been treated like a harlot. And then in this chapter, we have Tamar, who masquerades as a harlot. In each chapter, you find two brothers who act wickedly. In 34, it's Simeon and Levi. They go in and they wipe out the men of Shechem. Not a good idea. Here, it's Judah's two sons, Er and Onan, who God takes their lives because they're so wicked. Interesting chapters, but the outcomes could not be more different. So, let's get into it, but there's something I want you to focus on. Now, after chapter 38, we go back to the story of Joseph in Egypt. And that's the main focus of the chapters here on to the end of Genesis. But there's a secondary focus I don't want you to miss. And as we go through the chapters in the weeks to come, there's a second person, and that person is Judah. Because everything Joseph will do in the coming chapters is strategically placed around his brother Judah, who sold him into slavery, who betrayed him, who took his garment and dipped it in blood and presented it to Jacob. And said, look, is this Joseph's cloak here? and allowed his father to believe that Joseph had been torn to bits by a wild beast. So I want you to focus on Judah and the chapters to come as well. Now, the passage opens with this verse. Chapter 38, verse 1. It was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards an Adullamite man whose name was Hira. Why did Judah go down from his brothers? And the commentators all say, the sages over the millennia have said, this going down is not geographical. It's spiritual. Because in the previous chapter, he took the plot to kill Joseph and decided instead, oh, let's just sell him into slavery, which in some ways is even worse. Took his garment, his coat of many colors, his ketonet pasim, dipped it in goat's blood, and then presented it to Jacob to allow Jacob to believe that his son, beloved son Joseph, had been killed. The commentators say in the tradition in Judaism is that when the brothers saw the grief that this brought to Jacob, that it, like his heart had been ripped out, they all looked at Judah like, shouldn't we just tell him the truth? But Judah didn't. And Judah, who was the head of the tribes at that point, now is basically deposed from his position. Remember, Jacob's firstborn son was Reuben. But in chapter 35, Reuben goes and sleeps with Jacob's handmaid, Bilhah. So he loses his firstborn status. The second and third sons of Judah were Simeon and Levi. In chapter 34, they kill the men of Shechem. They really mess up. They lose their firstborn status. Now the fourth son, Judah, he's at the top of the heap. And what he did was as bad or worse than what the other brothers did. And now he's left. He's left his family. And you're going to see some hints that Judah is really, really depressed because he has sinned. He has grieved his father. He's betrayed his brothers. He has just betrayed who he is. He had to be thinking back to his great-grandfather Abraham. What a great man he was that God established a blood covenant with him. And then his grandfather Isaac had inherited that covenant and lived a godly life. Then his father, Jacob, who had been through so much and God had blessed in so many ways. And this is my heritage, and what have I done with it? I don't think we can imagine how depressed and sad Judah was. You know, Judas sold Yeshua. And he was so grief-stricken, went out and hanged himself. So here, this Judah has sold his brother Joseph. And in some ways, he's doing the same thing. He's just gone among the Canaanites. It's like life is worthless to me now. When we get to the end of the study, though, I want you to see one of the most amazing things that I think is contained in the Torah. By the way, I have to give you a quote from the Midrash Rabbah. It says, "The fathers of the tribes were busy selling Joseph. Jacob was distracted with his sackcloth and fasting. Judah was busy taking a wife. Meanwhile, the Holy One, blessed be He, was creating the light of Messiah." Because this chapter, you see God work in the midst of all the sin, all the deceptions, all the bad decisions, and you see God at work, not even a hiccup in His plan. But He uses every single rebellious and wrong thing and weaves it together to accomplish something amazing. That's the kind of God we have. So, let's get into it. All right, verse 2. There, Judah's gone down to Adullam, and there Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her and consorted with her. Now, the woman's name was not Shua. The man he met was Shua. It was Shua's daughter that he married. She conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er, E-R. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And yet again, and she bore a son and called his name Shelah. And it was in Chazib when she bore him. Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the eyes of Adonai. Now, if you read Hebrew, if you take the name Er, which is Ayin Resh, you just reverse it, Resh Ayin, Er becomes Ra, which means evil. Okay? So he just reverses his name and it tells you what Er was. He was evil. So Er was Ra. Er was evil. We don't know exactly what he did to deserve such judgment, but he was evil in the eyes of Adonai, and Adonai caused him to die. Then Judah said to Onan, consort with your brother's wife, with Tamar, and enter into levirate marriage with her, and establish offspring for your brother. Now this seems odd in our culture. This just simply isn't done these days. But in ancient times, this custom was really quite a brilliant one and quite a gracious and loving thing to do. Because a woman who was a widow without sons, without children, was in a really desperate place at that time. And so if a man died and left his wife a widow without children, without sons to raise up to his name, the man, if he had a brother, the brother or the closest relative, but generally the brother would come and he would take her as a wife, have children, have sons with her, and then those sons would take on the dead brother's name. It was an act of kindness. In fact, this tradition, which was considered in God's eyes to be so gracious and so good, became a commandment in the Torah for the Jewish people back in those days. So, what Judah tells Onan to do is a good thing. He says, consort with her, with your brother's wife, and to levirate marriage. It's called Yibum in Hebrew, and establish offspring for your brother. Verse 9, but Onan knew that the seed would not be his. So it was that whenever he would consort with his brother's wife, he would let it go to waste on the ground so as not to provide offspring for his brother. What he did was evil in the eyes of Adonai, and he caused him to die also. And then in verse 11, Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, lest he also die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Judah thought, okay, my oldest son Er married this woman, he died. But my second son went to be with her, he dies. It must be her fault. It wasn't her fault, it was their fault. They were evil. Then in verse 12, many days passed, and Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Now, how do you think Judah's feeling now? He was depressed already. He marries a Canaanite woman, which he knows is not real pleasing to God. She has three sons, and he may think, oh, my fortunes are turning around. Maybe God's going to bless me now. Son one dies, son two dies, and then his wife dies. He has a daughter-in-law who's now back to living with her father. Is a third son that is not fulfilling his duties. But then it says in verse 12, many days passed, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When Judah was consoled, he went up to oversee his sheep shears, he and his Adullamite friend, Hira, to Timnah. Excuse me. And Tamar was told as follows, behold, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garb from upon her, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself up. She then sat by the crossroads, which is on the road toward Timnah. Interesting figure of speech. Crossroads is what we have in our English, but in Hebrew it's two words. It's the petakanaim, the opening of the eyes. That's what a crossroad was called. You know, if you just have a path, you just kind of go along and you let your mind wander, and you know, and if you're riding a donkey, donkey kind of knows the way. But when you come to a crossroad, you have to open your eyes. Do I go straight? Do I turn right? Do I turn left? So the patak anaim, opening of the eyes, is what a crossroad is called. Just keep that in mind. Because what happens here is something God's going to use to begin to open the eyes of Judah. So she comes to and sat by the opening of the eyes, the crossroads, which is on the road toward Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, since she had covered her face. So he detoured to her by the road and said, "Come, if you please, let me consort with you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me if you consort with me?" He replied, "I will send you a kid of the goats from the flock." And she said, "Provided you leave a pledge until you send it." In other words, I don't know you. Can I really trust you to keep your word? You give me a security of some sort until you send that goat. And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, your signet ring, which is a sign of his authority, your wrap, his cloak, which is a symbol of his protection, and your staff that is in your hand. The staff is a sign of power and strength. Now, I can't claim to know what all is going through Judah's mind, but that's a really, really high price, worth a lot more than some old goat. And he gives them to a woman he doesn't know. What kind of person does that? I tell you, someone who's really depressed. He looks at a signet ring. "Yeah, that's me. It has my name Judah on it. But who cares? I'm not with my family. I've broken my father's heart. I sold my brother into slavery. My other brothers have no respect for him anymore. I don't have respect for myself. Sure, take the ring. My wrap, I don't care. My staff, take it." There's a man who just didn't care anymore. And so he pursues pleasure. He doesn't care the price. He gave them to her and consorted with her. And she conceived by him. Then she arose, left, removed her veil from upon her. She put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid of the goats through his friend, the Adullamite, to retrieve the pledge from the woman, but he did not find her. He inquired of the people of her place, "Where's the prostitute, the one of the crossroads by the road?" They said, "There is no prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her. Even the local men said, there is no one here." So Judah said, "Well, let her keep them, lest we look like fools, like laughingstock. Laboos, lest we look like a booze." A booze is the word for laughing stock or fool. "I really sent her this kid, but you could not find her. I mean, I kept my end of the bargain, but just leave it alone." Verse 24, "And it was when about 3 months had passed that Judah was told, 'Your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed harlotry. Moreover, she's conceived by harlotry. She's pregnant.' Judah said, 'Take her out, let her be burned.'" Now, that's not what you do with someone who's done that. He's just angry. He's lost two of his sons. He's lost his wife. He's lost his signet ring, his cloak, and his staff. He's lost the respect of his brothers. He's lost his father's love and affection, broken his heart. And now his daughter-in-law has betrayed him. And I think when he said, "Let her be burned," he's just saying, "Let it all burn to the ground. Life is worthless to me. Just let it all go." You begin to see just how dejected and depressed Judah had to have been. I apologize for the coughing. Robin gave me the gift of a lung infection. So we like to share everything together, even our sufferings. But thank you, dear. All right. As she was taken out, verse 25, she sent word to her father-in-law saying, now here's what she didn't say. She didn't say, "Well, you're the guy who made me pregnant. Look, I've got the proof right here. Everybody see, I've got the proof. It was him." That's not what she did. Look how gracious she is. She brings out these things and says, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Identify if you please. Whose are this signet, this wrap, and this staff? Judah recognized, and he said, she is more righteous than I. Inasmuch as I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he was not intimate with her anymore. Excuse me. Okay, I think I got it that time. Identify, if you please. In Hebrew, that's two words. Haker na. Haker na. Those two words in that phrase occur two places in the entire Bible. Here, where she holds out the signet, the wrap, and the staff, it says, Haker na. Identify, if you please. Where's the other place? Back in Genesis 37, just the previous chapter. Only other place this phrase is found. It's when Judah and his brothers take Joseph's coat of many colors that's been dipped in the blood. They go before Jacob, their father, and they say, Haker na, identify, if you please. Is this your son's coat or not? So Judah, who had deceived his father concerning Joseph's fate, now has been deceived. And the exact same words he spoke to his father are now spoken to him by his daughter-in-law. But whereas Judah's heart was wicked when he said those words and caused incredible grief, Tamar's heart was not. And her words brought repentance. And one of the things you'll find about Judah is whenever he's confronted with his sin, when he finally truly sees his sin, the repentance is immediate and thorough. It's a wonderful trait to have for a sinner. So yeah, so Genesis 37:32, here's the verse. And they sent the very colored tunic, the Ketonet Pasim, the coat of many colors, and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Hikerna, identify, if you please, to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. Oh, bless your heart. Water, thank you. All right. Excuse me. All right, thank you. Now a word about goats. I call these the goats of deception. I want you to go back to Jacob and Isaac. Jacob went in to Isaac, who was blind at the time, and Jacob masqueraded as his brother Esau. And how did he deceive his father? He put goat skin and hair on the backs of his hands, on the back of his neck. So when Isaac felt him, he says, well, yeah, you're hairy like Esau. So a goat was used by Jacob to deceive his father, Isaac. Now Jacob's son deceives him. He takes Joseph's coat of many colors and dips it in the blood of what? A goat. And when he takes it to his father Jacob, Jacob sees all the blood and thinks that's his son's blood. It's not his son's blood any more than Jacob's skin was Esau's skin and Esau's hands. So a goat is used again to deceive. And Judah, who deceived Jacob, who had deceived Isaac, is now deceived by a goat. Because when Tamar said, well, what are you going to give me? Oh, I'll give you a goat. Well, until you give me the goat, what are you going to give me? She had no intention of taking that goat. But she deceived Judah into thinking she would. So you find here a theme with goats. Goats are used to substitute one thing for another. But in each of these cases, you see a man or a woman using a goat. I'll just put man, representing mankind. When man uses a goat, it's used to deceive. But there's a goat that God uses. And what goat is that? The scapegoat, right? The goat to Azazel. Azazel, by the way, can be divided into two words. Az, which means goat, and Azel, which means to go away, the going away goat. And that's how it gets the name scapegoat. But God doesn't use it to deceive. He uses the goat to substitute because the only animal in the entire Bible that is said to actually bear away sins is in Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement, when the sins, even the willful and rebellious sins, are confessed over the head of the goat, of the entire nation. Then that goat is taken out in the wilderness. That goat is pushed over the cliff. That goat dies so that Israel doesn't. When God uses the goat, it's a substitute for something holy and good, not to deceive, but to deliver. Well, let's finish up the last few verses. Verse 27, and it came to pass at the time she gave birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it happened that as she gave birth, one put out a hand. The midwife took a crimson thread and tied it on his hand, saying, this one emerged first, and it was as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother emerged. So one baby puts out its hand and gets a red cord tied around it. This baby will be named Zerach, which means brightness. He pulls his hand back in. This is a strange birth. Any of you doctors ever seen one of these? I mean, really? And then, he pulls his hand back in with the red cord, and then his twin brother Perez, which means breach, a bursting forth. Perez is born. And then it says in verse 29, and it was as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother emerged. And she said, with what strength you asserted yourself. And he calls his name Perez. Afterwards, his brother, on whose hand was the crimson thread, came out. And he called his name Zerach. What is this all about? Well, some of you may remember when we've gone over this in the past, that here's a picture of Messiah's two advents. Here's a picture of his first advent. When Yeshua came the first time, how did that happen? There we go. Uh-oh. Everything's going haywire here. All right, let's just start this over. Now, you people listening, there we go. Listening online, you're missing all the drama here. All right, there we go. It's back up. This is a picture of Yeshua's first advent. See, when Zerach put his hand out, he was coming to visit, not to stay. And his hand came out just long enough to have a scarlet cord tied around it. Messiah came, he was here for 33 years. And that scarlet cord's a picture of blood and of death. And he came and he died, and then he left. When he returned, as Zerah came back later with the red cord, he came to stay. And you knew it was Zerah because he came with proof of his identity, the red cord on his hand. And as Yeshua returns someday, we'll see the nail marks in his hands and in his feet and the scar in his side. He'll come back with proof of his identity. And this time is to come to stay and never leave again. In the meantime, we have this one whose name is Breach. You know who that is? That's us. That's us. I think that's us. Because we are the ones who are born in between. And we're born by an incorruptible seed. And we're born into this kingdom. And this is one of the reasons I think in Hebrews, Yeshua is called our elder brother, and his desire is to bring many brothers into salvation. So in many ways, we're a twin. The evil twin, but the twin. The twin who seeks to be more like him. But he's not ashamed to call us brothers. That's an amazing thing. Well, that's a teaching all by itself right there. I see a hand up, so let's get a microphone over to Adam. That'll give me time to cough. Are we on?
Check.
There we are.
It just says, there we go. So, as some of you are aware, Rihanna's pregnant, and we've been taking birthing classes, and I was just reflecting on there's two really bizarre births in Scripture. Like, Jacob and Esau, bizarre to the point of being miraculous. But I was thinking about this one, and the only way it's possible for the hand to have been out is the baby's head would have had to been right there, ready to be born, and would have had to completely remove himself from the birth process, and the other baby gotten pushed down. And it is, like you're saying, it's just such a strong image of Christ was right there, ready, and he had to choose to completely remove himself from that trajectory in order to get us into the picture and push us into the picture and then for the delivery. So it is just, it's exactly medically, it's insane.
Yeah. Who could come up with an image like this, though, but other than God? I mean, really, it's an amazing image. And Rick, yes.
I'm just curious. In this chapter, everyone is named except the woman that Judah takes for his wife. Is there some significance for that? I mean,
is there a significance to why Judah's wife is not named? I can take one guess. What's the number 13 represent? The number 13 in Scripture, in Hebrew. Love, yes, very good. The word ahava, aleph he, beit he, has a numerical value of 13. Okay, and ahava, love, equals 13. Also, the word ichad, one, has a numerical value of 13, because love makes two into one. All right? Guess how many names are mentioned in this chapter? Exactly 13. 13 names. And if they named Judah's wife, there'd be 14. I think God's trying to tell us in this weird, oddball chapter where you see sin, you see deception, you see all these things going wrong, God's love to bring about the light of Messiah is all at work in all of this. And what's interesting, that phrase where Judas says, take her out, let her be burned, four words in Hebrew. You take the first letter of those four words that spells in order, yud, he, vav. Even God is there in the hidden way. In the wicked words of Judah, God is still there in the scenes. You see, Perez, this one here, became a physical ancestor of Yeshua. And if you look in the first chapter of, boy, that's horrible handwriting, isn't it? Let me do that again. Y-E-S-H-U-A. There we go. If you look in the first chapter of Matthew, you'll see Perez mentioned as one of the ancestors of Messiah. All right? And that word Zerach, brightness, I love this passage, this messianic passage. In Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 3, it says, arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of Adonai has risen upon you. For behold, darkness will cover the earth, and deep darkness the peoples, the Gentiles. But Adonai will rise upon you, and his glory will appear upon you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to Zerach of your rising, to the brightness of your rising. There's the word Zerach. I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful passage. Well, now we're going to completely shift gears. Completely shift gears. We're going to talk about our two main characters individually. Tamar and Judah. Now, this chapter is a place where it's like all these different threads from different passages all come together to one central character, and that's Tamar. This kind of an odd individual, a Canaanite woman who's taken as a wife for Judah's son. She masquerades as a harlot to bring about great righteousness, to bring forth one of the ancestors of Messiah. And she begins to lead Judah to repentance. You can see her actions, though they are not a recommended course of action if you ever find yourself in her position. Nevertheless, were orchestrated by God. And so I have this section called Maidens of Misunderstanding, which is not the most appropriate title, but I thought it was so clever, I stuck with it. You've got chapter 38 here in the story of Tamar. But let's start with this. Do you know there are two Tamars in the Bible? Only two? There's this Tamar here, but there's another Tamar over in 2 Samuel 13. This Tamar was a daughter of King David. And she had a wicked brother named Amnon. And Tamar was a beautiful, beautiful young woman. And if you read the story, it's a horrible story. Amnon lusted for his sister. And his lust became so strong, he thought it was love. And he was just sick at home thinking about Tamar. And finally, one day, he lures her into his room, pretending he's sick, and basically accosts her and takes her virginity. Then after he does that, it says he hated her. And his hatred for her afterward was greater than his love for her was before. Had her thrown out of his house, had the servant throw her out and bar the door. And Tamar was just broken. Now, what's interesting is that Tamar and Joseph have some interesting connections. Do you know that word ketonet pasim, the coat of many colors? It's only used in two stories the entire Bible. It appears twice. It appears in the story of Joseph, and then it says in 2 Samuel 13 that Tamar wore a ketonet pasim, a coat of many colors. And just as Joseph was betrayed by his brother Judah, she was betrayed by her brother Amnon. And just as Joseph's ketonet pasim was torn and dipped in blood and presented to the father, after her desecration by Amnon, it says she tore her coat in her grief, just tore it and ripped it, put ashes on her head. There's a connection there. Two Tamars. But then I asked you also in the email, I said, it says Tamar veiled herself. There's only one other woman in the Bible who said was said to veil herself. Who was that? It was Rebecca. Only two women in the Bible who are specifically said they veiled themselves. And what else did Tamar and Rebecca have in common? What was that? I heard somebody say it. Twins. Tamar gave birth to twins. Rebecca gave birth to twins. Jacob and Esau. Very good. Only two women in the Bible who have a story where they give birth to twins. Only two, Tamar and Rebecca. And Rebecca, you know, she was an interesting person. She's the one who engineered the deception of her husband Jacob. I mean, her husband Isaac. Because she told Jacob, now Jacob, you put on Esau's clothes so you'll smell like him. You put this goat hair on the back of your neck and your hand so you'll feel like him. And you go in there and you pretend you are him. And you'll get the blessing from your father instead of Esau. In you know where it says there that Jacob saw Tamar there at the crossroads and he thought her to be a harlot? That phrase, and he thought her, he considered her, is one word in Hebrew. And it's v'yakshaveya. V'yakshaveya. Now, it's used once, it's used three times in the Bible. All three times in Genesis. And the first two times in Genesis. Used once of God concerning Abraham. But it's only used two times. The other two times are by a man concerning a woman. In this case, it's Tamar, where Judah saw Tamar, who was actually a righteous woman, and he thought she was a harlot. It's used again in 1 Samuel 1:13, where Eli, the high priest, sees Hannah praying in the tabernacle, and her lips are moving, and he thinks she is a drunk. Only two times where it's used of a man. The other third time is God, who considered Abraham righteous. It says, and Abraham believed God, and God, Miachshaveya, considered him righteous. Interesting, isn't it? This connection. Let me bring up the other connection. I see a hand up. Here's another one. How about the red string? What are the two stories where we find a red string? Tamar, red string put on Zerah's hand. And then Rahab the harlot, an actual harlot, who lived in Jericho. But she had faith in God, and she protected the spies who came from the Israelites. She protected them, saved their lives. And as a result, they said, You put the red string in your window, and when we come to attack Jericho, you and everyone in your house will be spared. Oh, here's another one. Samson's wife, not Delilah. I don't think he married Delilah. He did marry another woman. At least he planned to, but you can read all about it in Judges 14. Terrible story. But it all took place in Timnah. In Genesis 38, it mentions Timnah three times. Then here in Judges 14, Timnah is mentioned three times. And Samson, he laid eyes on this woman and decided he loved her. He went home to mom and dad, said, I found myself a woman. I want her. Go get her. They went down, negotiated the price, and when they were having the big wedding feast, they had the contest of the riddles. And someone paid off Timnah to tell them what the solution to Samson's riddle was, and it made him blazing mad. You can read the whole story. But all these unique connections. Hannah, who's considered a drunk. Tamar, who is raped by her brother. Rebecca, who is kind of a shifty woman, even though she's considered one of the righteous. Rahab, who was a harlot. Samson's wife, who's a kind of a two-timer and a backstabber. But all these connections of women who also were victims in many ways. This would make a great women's Bible study. But the connections all come together in Genesis 38 with this one figure. They all point to Genesis 38. So I'm going to stop there with this part. If you're taking notes, this would be a great springboard for a study. But I just wanted to share this with you, this unique, amazing chapter. Now, there was a hand up back here. I think Mim had her hand up. Just got a microphone to her.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you for keeping that up because that's helped me. As you were teaching, I was thinking about the verse that talks about that men look on the outward appearance and the Lord looked at the heart.
Yes.
And we need discernment from the Lord daily because, you know, the outward appearance of these women can fool you.
Yes.
But we need discernment from the Lord.
Yes, we do. We do. And, I just made these discoveries this week, and I thought, well, I've got to share them, even though I haven't explored them all out. Like, what are the connections here? And there are probably others. I have five different women here. Hannah, Rebecca, Samson's wife, Rahab, and then the other Tamar. But there might be others as well that you can discover. But chapter 38 is like where all these different threads from these different stories come together in one place. That's an amazing thing. God, isn't God's Torah just awesome? Who could write a book like this? Not a man. No man could ever write this. Here's what I want us to do next. Let's go back to Judah now. And again, do I need to review all the horrible things that have happened to Judah and because of his own bad decisions? His jealousy of Joseph, selling him to slavery, breaking his father's heart, being deceived by this woman who turns out is his daughter-in-law and giving her his staff and cloak and signet ring and just losing his two sons because they were evil, his wife dying. He's just depressed. What kind of future do you think you would have if you were Judah in this chapter? Pretty bleak, huh? Maybe that's where you're at now. I don't know. Made mistakes? You sinned, and maybe the sin in your life is so horrible, so great, you think, he's done with me. Not much. I had potential, but God can't use me now. Maybe that's where you feel. Well, let me tell you what happens with Judah. I'm going to go all the way to chapter 49 of Genesis. Judah's father, Jacob, is on his deathbed. And he prophesies over each one of his sons. This is what he says about Judah. It's in Genesis 49, verses 8 to 12. Just listen. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have arisen. You've gone up. He couches. He lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And Shiloh is understood in Judaism always as being Messiah. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk. Now, what does that mean? Almost all of those references are going back to Judah's errors and saying, no, Judah, I've taken sin that you've committed and turned it around. Where sin abounded, grace superabounded. Let me show you how each of your errors and sins has been turned on its head, and I'm going to use them for my glory. Let's pick this apart a verse at a time. Genesis 49, verse 8. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Why did he go to Adullam? According to tradition, his brothers kind of rejected him. Man, we're not going to follow you. We should never listen to you. You're supposed to be in charge. We followed you, and what a mess. It broke our father's heart. He's been grieving for 20 years. Sold our brother into slavery, and that was Judah's idea. But he says, your brothers will praise you. What is it Judah's going to do to deserve their praise? Your hands will be on the neck of your enemies instead of your brother you're jealous of. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Now, wait a minute. What was it that made Judah so jealous of Joseph? It was his dreams. And what took place in Joseph's dreams? The brothers bowed down to Joseph. And yet God speaks through Jacob, the heartbroken one, and says, Judah, your brothers are going to bow down to you. How do you wrap your head around that? This one who thought he had lost every ounce of respect his brothers could ever have says, your brothers will praise you. They'll bow down to you. In fact, as Judah's tribe becomes the kingly tribes, the kings of Israel come from Judah, like David, like Messiah. And then it says, oh, I love this. Judah is a lion's whelp. He's a lion's cub from the prey. Now, I want you to look at that word prey. That word prey is the word traif. You familiar with the word traif? Those of you who know the laws of kashrut, of kosher eating, you know that anything that's torn is called traif. You don't eat meat that's roadkill or killed by another animal. You only eat meat that's been slaughtered and then the blood drained. But if it's been torn by another animal, if you hit it with your car, you think, I'll just throw it in the back and clean it and eat it for supper. You don't do that. And the word traif has now come to apply to any kind of unkosher meat. They just expanded the definition. But the definition of the word traif is torn, the tear. Now, what did Jacob say? What were his exact words when they brought Joseph's bloody coat to him and said, identify, if you please? Jacob, just his heart, it felt like it was ripped out of his chest. And he says, my son has been tarof, taraf, which is the word traif twice, but pronounced differently. Tearing, he has been torn. He is certainly torn to pieces by a wild beast. My son has become traif, torn to pieces. Now that word had to be in Judah's mind when he heard these words from Jacob. It says, Judah's a lion's cub. From the traif, my son, you have gone up. In other words, you descended to such a low place, you allowed your father, you deceived your father into thinking your brother had been torn to pieces. But you know what? You've risen up. back. Hello? There we go. Now that's magic. Twice he has approached a platform and he gets halfway and everything just goes back to normal. Your car ever breaks down, just say, Tim, would you drive halfway over? All right. He couches, he lies down as a lion, who dares rouse him up? In other words, Judah, you're going to become dangerous, not to your brothers, not to your dad. You're going to become dangerous to the enemy. And then it says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Now, this is kind of interesting. He gave his staff to a woman he thought was a prostitute. Right? He says, you're never going to give your staff away again. In fact, your staff's going to become a scepter. Royalty will descend from you. Until Shiloh comes. Oh, this is interesting. What was Judah's third son's name? Shelah, which means deceit and disappointment. You add a yud to the middle of that, it becomes Shiloh, the peace bringer. It's a reference to Messiah. Shelah came, never mounted anything, but Shiloh's coming. He'll save the world. It says he ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robe in the blood of grapes. He'd already washed one robe in blood. Whose was that? Joseph's. But now it's talking about wine and grapes. And down here, his eyes are dull from wine and his feet, teeth white from milk. But these are references not to Judah becoming an alcoholic and a drunk. But wine and milk are symbolic words for the messianic kingdom. And sure enough, in Judah's inheritance, many years later, and Israel comes in and conquers the land and settles, Judah's is the place where the grape, the vines were, the vineyards were, and where the cattle were that provided milk. Judah's territory became very rich. They say you could tie a donkey to one spot in a grapevine, and that donkey could eat grapes that was so full, the donkey could not eat another grape, yet there's still grapes left. And Isaiah 55:1 says, ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. This is a prophecy of the messianic kingdom. And Joel 3:17-18. Then you will know that I am Adonai your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. So Jerusalem will be holy, and strangers will pass through it no more. And in that day the mountains will drop with sweet wine, and the hills will flow with milk. Again, wine and milk. There's also another hidden prophecy in here. The word for a donkey's colt is the word ear. And it is a word, let me just spell it here. It means a donkey's colt, but it also means a city. Yerushalayim is Ir Shalom, the city of peace. So it could say that you're going to tie your city to the choice vine. Who's the one who said, I am the vine, you're the branches? It's Yeshua. Everything has a second meaning. And often the second meaning is even more beautiful than the surface one. So I'll finish with a quote we started with. Excuse me. That wasn't it. The fathers of the tribes were busy selling Joseph. Jacob was distracted with his sackcloth and fasting. Judah was busy taking a wife. Meanwhile, the Holy One, blessed be he, was creating the light of Messiah. That's the kind of God we have. That's the kind of God that we have. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that amazing? When you look at the prophecy of Judah, you start with what his life is like in chapter 38. Then you see the prophecy of what his life will be. Could even be the same guy. And you know it is. Because everything's in the items in that beautiful prophecy find their source right back in chapter 38. This is the God we have. And I don't care what kind of sin you've committed in your life, or maybe whatever kind of sin you're in the middle of now. Your sin is no threat to God. Your sin is no big deal compared to what he can do with a sinner when the sinner repents of the sin. It's no threat to him. It's still sin, it's still wrong, and God doesn't want you to do it. He hates it, and it's deadly, but he hates it because of what it does to you, not because of what it does to him. You're the victim of your sin. So are your friends and your family and society. They suffer from your sin. God doesn't. He suffered for it. And he's conquered it. And he's forgiven it. He's waiting for you to catch up with what he's already done. And when you turn from it and see your sin for what it is, and quit using, well, God's just done with me. Quit using that as an excuse. He's not done with you. He's waiting for you to be done with your sin. And when you finally put it aside, say, I'm done with that. Here, I'm yours. And God said, well, I've been waiting. Now let's take all the mess of your life. And I'm going to take every negative in your life, turn it upside down and make it a positive now. And everything you did wrong is going to become something in my hand that becomes wonderful and good. That's the kind of God we have. And a God less than that would not be a God worth worshiping in my book. And I think since my mic died, I should just shut up. So let's pray. Our Father and King, thank you so much for your blessings and your goodness to us. Lord, forgive us for such small faith. Forgive us for underestimating your salvation. Forgive us for underestimating your omnipotence, your sovereignty, your wisdom, your omniscience. And Father, the God who can take manure and turn it into roses and cabbage and carrots and beets and corn and bring forth life and food out of something that's rotten and waste. The same God who can do that in each of our lives. So, Lord, I pray you move upon all of our hearts that we would just renew our commitment to give ourselves to you. You are our source and you are our goal. And in between, we've made a mess of things. But, Father, even our messes become positives when given to you. So, Lord, there's not one thing we've did in sin and rebellion in the past that can't be used by you if we let go of it and give it up. So, Father, make us the people you want us to be. We'll give you every bit of the glory and the thanks and the praise for it. In Yeshua's name, amen. And, Tim, if you'd come and lead us in the blessing. Let's stand together.